Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the NFL lockout of referees, which resulted in a series of blown calls from replacement refs, otherwise known as scabs, that robbed the Green Bay Packers of a victory on Monday night's football game against Seattle. An irate Packers fan, Rudy Batzel, from Paul Ryan's congressional district, as well as longtime sports columnist for the New York Times and author Robert Lipsight, join us to discuss the contempt NFL owners appear to have for the professionalism of their employees, not to mention the fans, players, and the game itself. Then, following today's charges brought against an Army general for forcible sodomy, adultery, and inappropriate relations with a female subordinate while serving in Afghanistan, we will speak with Jennifer Norris, who was forced into early retirement from the United States Air Force because of PTSD from military sexual trauma. We will discuss whether a trial of such a high-ranking officer will help expose the epidemic of sexual violence in the military. Then finally, we will look into President Obama's address to the Clinton Global Initiative on the global scourge of human bondage, slavery, and sex trafficking. A victim of sex trafficking who at the age of 12 was kidnapped and forced into sex slavery, Carissa Phelps, joins us. The author of Runaway Girl, Escaping Life on the Streets, One Helping Hand at a Time, Carissa is now an attorney and youth advocate who helps local and international survivors of sex trafficking rebuild their lives. Joining us now is Robert Lipsight, who is a longtime sports and city columnist of the New York Times and the author of a recent memoir, An Accidental Sports Writer, just out in paperback, and Sports World, An American Dreamland. He was a correspondent for CBS's Sunday Morning and for NBC Nightly News. And also joining us is Rudy Batzel, who is a graduate student at Harvard University studying economic and social history. He is a Packers fan from Paul Ryan's 1st Congressional District in Wisconsin and has an article in Jacobin magazine, Nationalized Football, A Modest Proposal to Save the National Football League. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Lipsight and Rudy Batzel. Robert, let me start out with you. First of all, do you accept my kind of scolding premise that this these blown calls from these replacement refs, otherwise known as scabs, appears to show a contempt that NFL owners have for the professionalism of their employees, not to mention the fans, players, and the game itself?
Well, I mean, if they were actually contemptuous of the professionalism of all those people, at least there would be a central human intelligence involved. I don't think it even goes that far. Almost none of them are actual football owners per se. The game does not supply their income. They've made their money in this kind of arrogant 1% kind of way in real estate or pizza or something else. And for them, football is a kind of sandbox. It's bragging rights. It's also a way, of course, of doing business with other businessmen up in their skyboxes. It's a way of being important in their community, having some levels of political power. So I think their contempt is almost too strong. I don't think they really care. I don't think they really see these people. And the idea that at a time when the game is really in crisis for very specific safety reasons, that referees who cannot really control a game and could lead players to greater injury are allowed to officiate, is kind of mind-boggling.
Let me ask Rudy Batzel, who is from he's a Packers fan from Paul Ryan's 1st Congressional District. It seems that both your union-busting Governor Scott Walker and the Republican nominee for Vice President, your Congressman Paul Ryan, going through a certain amount of cognitive dissonance here in being critical of the non-union refs, What's going on here? It seems to me that we have a problem in this country, that there are a lot of people who don't like unions, who teach their kids, but it seems when it comes to football, they reverse themselves.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great point. I hope that it wasn't a point I could make in the article, but I think this is a great way for people to learn about broader labor issues going on in the country. I mean, you can see the difference in the quality of the game with these scabs coming in, and you know, the players are being put at risk. You know, they're putting their bodies on the line, and the game is not being played safely. And you know, even the casual fan can see this happening. And it shows you what unions do. You know, unions are not just about, you know, higher wages or benefits, but it's about the quality of work being done. So I think it's a great moment to have a conversation in this country about what labor unions do and what working class power means. I just want to also, you know, these owners, you know, they don't care about the game. And the idea that they have any role to play in the game is absurd. You know, they're just sitting up in their skyboxes, you know, networking with their corporate pals, and they're used to getting their way. They're used to, you know, union busting and breaking the backs of working people left and right. And, you know, they have no real commitment. And the beautiful thing, the point I try to make in my article is that, you know, Green Bay shows the way, because there's no owners in Green Bay. It's a community-owned franchise. It's nonprofit. There's no reason that the game should be destroyed by these sort of, you know, capitalists just, you know, buying up a team and having no real appreciation for the game of football.
So Robert Lipside, again, a longtime sports and city columnist for the New York Times and author of the recent memoir, An Accidental Sports Writer. What's going on with the bookies? I mean, my understanding is that there's a whole other sort of side industry going on with the NFL, that every weekend over $1 billion is bet, most of it illegally, some of it legally through Las Vegas sports bookies. One Las Vegas sports bookie apparently is offering a refund on the game. Do you think there's a lot of irate calls to bookies going on?
Well, yeah, and I think that in calling it a side business might be diminishing its importance. I've always felt that gambling was one of the main fuels of football fandom. Yeah, I mean, of course, there are, you know, Rudy and Crazy Cheeseheads out there, Green Bay fans, and there are people who love the game, love the violence of the game, the incredible thrills and excitement of the game. But I know far too many people who are very sophisticated bettors about the game, who are very, very concerned about how the lines and the various handicaps projections can be messed up by these scab referees. Not to mention, which nobody really wants to mention, is the fact that if anybody could fix a game, and by fix I don't necessarily mean winning or losing, I mean manipulating the spread, the differential between the two teams, which is really the heart of gambling, it would be replacement referees, guys who, you know, have no long-term investment in the game, and could be gotten to. I mean, some of these people obviously shouldn't be refereeing your junior high school game. I mean, there are people reportedly who were referees for the Lingerie League, which is a women's, it's kind of a joke women's football league, and who were fired as incompetent. There are very few guys with any real experience, certainly not the experience to handle that play that we saw at the end of the Green Bay Seahawks game, where there were several serious mistakes made. The point is that inexperienced referees simply cannot keep control of the game. And you know, you talked about the contempt that the owners feel, the contempt that the coaches and players have expressed has really been damaging. A writer for Yahoo, or the Andy Sweat, I think his name is, he talked about inexperienced babysitters and brats as a way of looking at the players. The players have been shoving, mouthing off, really disrespecting the referees, and so have the coaches, who have handily used them often as excuses for games that they've lost. Although I think Green Bay has a real excuse.
Again, I'm speaking with Robert Litzeit and Rudy Batzel, who's a graduate student at Harvard University studying economic and social history. He's a Packers fan from Paul Ryan's 1st Congressional District in Wisconsin and has an article in Jacobin magazine, Nationalized Football, A Modest Proposal to Save the National Football League. Rudy, you mentioned the kind of capitalist ruthlessness, if you will, of the NFL owners and what they represent. But I've noticed over the years that there's a kind of sport, if you will, on television. It's kind of ghoulish in a way, of when coaches lose and are about to be fired, and all of these sports writers and commentators commentate on this coach, and quite often this results in a kind of public humiliation of a middle-aged man whose life and career is being wrecked, and I find it really kind of upsetting to watch. So, do you in the broader discussion of sports, do you notice that as well?
I think yeah. You know, often you'll have a coach who, you know, for reasons not under their control, ends up having a bad season, and public anger builds around them, and it can be quite a spectacle. But the coaches, along with the players and the referees, these are the folks who produce the value, the product of the game that we love, football. And, this spectacle, then the owner will usually be the one who comes in and gives the coach, the axe. I mean, you look at the NFL and most of the major sports leagues, the players get about half the revenue, and the rest gets divided between a variety of things. And but the idea that the owners are actually extracting a portion of the revenue produced by the players, by the coaches, and by the officials, it's just absurd. There's absolutely no reason the owners should have any role to play in this game. And Green Bay, it actually exists. Green Bay thrives as a team, and they don't have any owners. There's no need for these folks, and I think this is the lockout here just illustrates how damaging having the owners can be for the game.
Ian, I think you're not tough enough to watch this game.
You think I'm too soft-hearted towards the working man? Is that what you're saying?
I think you're too soft. Yes, I think so. I mean, if you're willing to accept, which I am, that this really is the bread and circuses of America. Someone is writing a book now called The National Passion, and I think this is true. I mean, it's really all these kind of visceral feelings. Americans get off on the violence of the game. Everything else is kind of a cosmetic. How difficult it is, the X's and O's, the plays, the cleverness of the coaches and all the different kinds of coaches. But that, combined with the gambling, which is also a kind of psychic violence, the idea that this is the last place in America that's only for men. I mean, they are going to be Navy SEALettes before there are going to be, NFL women players. We're going through a period now where it's generally the conventional wisdom that is that men are over. But here's a place where they're not over, that really big men, the owners, hire, the straw bosses, the Simon Legrees, the coaches that, you are feeling so sad about, for millions of dollars. You know, they've come from college where they made more than the college president, and now they make even much more than the college president, to keep control of these somewhat psychotic players. I mean, I've watched this over the years as the NFL has expanded and reached, you know, deeper and deeper into the pool of American men. And I think that the best players that we've had, tend to be sociopaths, certainly on the field and very often off it. So I think that we've got all these things going on. And what's so interesting about right now is that it's all come to a head where, the substitute teachers, the policemen, the people who are supposed to, you know, control this violent chaos on the field are unable to do it. And the reason that they're unable to do it is because these owners, in their arrogance, in their having to win, weren't going to let this union of real referees beat them.
Right, but all for $3 million, though. We're talking about, that's tip money for those guys.
I think we need Reagan back to fire all the air traffic controllers. They should let them fire all these referees and train and, you know, then take a couple of weeks off from the season and train, you know, new ones. But no, they're kind of sticking it, you know, to the referees. And I can't believe that they won't settle within a week or so.
Well, Rudy, what about the there's so many different subjects in there that have been brought up here, all of which I think are in many ways swept under the rug. And Robert Lipsight mentioned the injuries. There seems to be massive denial going on in that regard. I noticed they gave a tribute to Junior Seau recently down in San Diego. And of course, he shot himself. There was no mention of that. There was all these tributes, but to do with apparent brain damage. And there's no question that these collisions are similar to what the troops are going through when they get blown up in Afghanistan and Iraq.
You know, I mean, I think, you know, there was a great example of how the game is getting out of control. Greg Jennings was coming across the middle, and, you know, the play was basically over, and it was the safety of the cornerback just laid him out in the, you know, the middle of the field. You know, that's, you know, these guys, I mean, I agree, the game is violent, the game is brutal, and I think, of course, that's where part of its appeal comes from. But I don't think these guys are sociopaths. I don't think we should, stigmatize them like that. I think they play the game. I think they play a tough, violent game with passion. But I think you have a whole variety of folks playing football who, some of them I think are quite nasty characters. You know,
come on, Rudy. The statistic of something like 50% of them have been indicted for high misdemeanors or felonies. So there's a very high level of antisocial behavior among these football players, and I really think that. Yeah, I mean, some of them are really,
really
fun to be with, and they're lovely guys. But I think much like soldiers back from Afghanistan who can't really turn it off right away and the trouble that they get into and the idea that when you're conditioned since you're 8 or 9 years old to this constant violence and you're getting your head beat, and we don't really know how much of the way that they act out off the field may very well have to do with all those years of head trauma. I mean, there's so much we don't really know about it because we don't want to know about it. We just want to sit in front of the set and get it off.
And it's not likely. Go ahead.
I'm glad we can be having this conversation because, I mean, I think, you know, this is part of, you know, people like to gripe about athletes' salaries being so high, but I think the point you raise is that they're dedicating their entire lives to this sport. I mean, they will not be able to go on and lead, have a different career after they play football. It does condition you, and I think, you know, it has an impact on your body and on your mind. So when they have, a typical career of, you know, 2 or 3 years, actually, you know, in the, at the pro level, you know, we have to think of this as being compensation for an entire lifetime dedicated to this sport.
Sure, and by the time they're middle-aged, a lot of them can't walk. Is that right, Robert?
I've never interviewed, and I've been doing this 55 years, I have never interviewed a former NFL player in his 50s who could get out of a soft chair by himself.
Well, there you have it.
Yeah.
So just in closing, Robert, you said you think this thing will be over by the weekend?
I think it has to be. I mean, what happened at Green Bay, you know, it was because it was on prime time, the only game on, and such a high-profile game, Monday Night Football, that, you know, it was really stuck in our faces. I mean, there have been a lot of blown calls. There are a lot of unhappy football fans, and I think that, you know, the game is, because of the concussions, because of Bounty Gate, because of a growing feeling in the country, is it really moral to watch these games, much less to send your kids off to play? It's like sending your young sons and daughters to war. I think that they're going to have to get the referees back. They have to get, you know, some sort of patina of normalcy back to the game.
Well, I thank both of you for joining us here today. Rudy Batsel, who's a graduate student at Harvard University studying economic and social history. He's a Packers fan from Paul Ryan's 1st Congressional District in Wisconsin and has an article in Jacobin magazine, Nationalized Football, A Modest Proposal to Save the National Football League. And Robert Lipside, a longtime sports and city columnist for the New York Times and author of the recent memoir An Accidental Sports Writer, just out in paperback, and Sports World and American Dreamland. He was a correspondent for CBS Sunday Morning and for NBC Nightly News. Thank you both, gentlemen, for joining us.
Thank you. What fun. Go Green Bay.
Okay.
Absolutely. Go Brewers.
Okay. Thank you both. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about how U.S. General is being charged now with serious sex crimes. We'll talk further about that.
I work for the union because she's so good to me.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Jennifer Norris, who's a former U.S. Air Force tech sergeant who was forced into early retirement because of post-traumatic stress disorder from military sexual trauma. She currently volunteers at the Military Rape Crisis Center, helping both active duty and veterans victims of sexual violence. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jennifer Norris.
Thank you very much.
And today, Brigadier General Jeffrey Sinclair, the Deputy Commanding General of the 82nd Airborne Division at its forward base in Afghanistan, has been charged with forcible sodomy, multiple counts of adultery, and having inappropriate relationships with female subordinates while serving in Afghanistan. This is pretty unusual, isn't it? Somebody of that rank being charged with that many serious crimes?
Yes, it is. One of the biggest reasons that this has become as big a deal as it has is because he was in Afghanistan. And in Afghanistan, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, and Iraq, General Order 1 is issued, which prohibits use of alcohol, pornography, and sex of any kind due to the cultural issues and out of respect for that culture. So breaking General Order 1 as a brigadier general is a pretty big deal.
So we don't know much more than the fact that he's just been charged. Do you have any further information about where is he at the moment? Do we know?
From what I understand, he's back in the States.
At Fort Bragg?
Yes.
At Fort Bragg, right. That which is the headquarters of the 82nd Airborne.
Yes. And from what I understand in doing a little bit of research on the subject today, is that there's additional charges, including fraudulent use of a government credit card, adultery, forced sex, sodomy, use of alcohol. All of these things are big no-nos in the military, but especially because of General Order 1 in Afghanistan with the prohibition of alcohol and anything that has to do with pornography or sex.
So
that's really upped it.
So what's your understanding then, Jennifer Norris, of having been a victim of sexual assault in the military and being forced into early retirement because of post-traumatic stress disorder from these unwanted sexual attacks? And you're currently volunteering at the Military Rape Crisis Center. So you must have an idea of how pervasive this is. I spoke with a Navy captain a while back who was a victim of the Tailhook scandal, and there was also a very, very powerful film that came out fairly recently that indicated this problem is vast. I mean, there are, I think, hundreds of thousands of women in the military have been assaulted.
Yes, sir. Unfortunately, the DOD's own estimates are at least 19,000 sexual assault, rape, sexual harassment cases a year, but they only had about 3,200 that report, and the majority of them are not reporting for fear of retaliation. So part of my job at the Military Rape Crisis Center is to at least provide an outlet for someone who's active duty that's been through a trauma, like sexual assault or rape, so they at least have someone to talk to and a way to get help without having to necessarily report it, but take care of themselves at the same time. If I had it to do over again, I don't even know if I would have reported, because I did end up reporting all four of my assaults, four different perpetrators within the first 2 years of my career. And unfortunately, I too got retaliated against. I don't know if it's because people didn't know the whole story or what, but I ended up being retaliated against in many different ways by my chain of command. They knew him, or at least one of the perpetrators, a lot longer than they had known me. So in a lot of cases, there's a lot of conflict of interest with dealing with reporting the crime to someone in your chain of command, because the bias is that they've known that person, that perpetrator, a lot longer than they've known you. And that's what's hurting the justice process.
And how far up the chain of command did your complaints go?
Well, mine went all the way to the National Guard Bureau, because once someone reports a crime within your unit, it goes all the way up the chain of command. And basically, my squadron would have to answer to not only the wing, but also National Guard with reporting. And one of the downfalls with my case, and I didn't pick up on it then because I was just wanted it over, was that the charges got knocked down from sexual assault to sexual harassment.
And they
got reported as sexual harassment when they were in fact sexual assault.
And you said there were four separate airmen involved in the sexual assaults on you?
Yes, and they were airmen, but they were also non-commissioned officers. They were my superiors. So they had a lot more rank than I did and a lot more time in service. All of them had over 15 years of service.
And were there any of them officers? They're all NCOs?
These were all NCOs, yes.
And essentially, they blamed the victim?
Yes, basically. You know, they know everyone. They've known everyone a lot longer than I did, so they can easily just spread the rumor mill that, you know, I'm this or I'm that, whatever it is that they decide they're going to say about me, to turn people against me. And the next thing you know, I'm having to leave the squadron because I just can't get anywhere, because they, are just looking for things to give me a hard time about, you know, trying to get me in trouble for things that were pretty much just made up. It just never ended. I couldn't get training on the equipment that I needed to get promoted. They were holding me back from that. So they were basically just trying to isolate me until I gave up. And this is the kind of mentality, this barbaric mentality that's causing people to get pushed to the point of suicide. You get treated so badly during the trauma, but then you're re-traumatized afterwards by a culture that it just makes you wonder if something is wrong with you because everyone's coming down on you for a crime that was committed by a predator.
Again, I'm speaking with Jennifer Norris, a former U.S. Air Force tech sergeant. She was forced into early retirement because of post-traumatic stress disorder from military sexual trauma. She currently volunteers at the Military Rape Crisis Center, helping both active duty and veteran victims of sexual violence. So it would seem to me, though, Jennifer, that having a general officer charged with these serious crimes, it's got to change the environment. You just told us how you were twice victimized by the four sexual predators who assaulted you, and then on top of that, by the concerted and orchestrated cover-ups that they were all involved in that punished you again and ruined your career.
Yeah.
So obviously with a general essentially in the dock here, this has got to get some more attention. I know from that film that I mentioned, The Invisible War, a lot of women in Congress and in the Senate have weighed in, but it sounds like, you know, this has been so glacial in trying to get some action from the military. This has gone on for a long time. You know, Paula Coughlin told me after Tailhook, she actually met with the President of the United States in the Oval Office and brought him to tears, but nothing happened.
Yep. You know, I work with her now. And it's amazing to hear that she went through what we're going through to this day, and it's only escalated. Because if you let a predator go, they're going to keep re-victimizing over and over and over because they know they can get away with it. So that's why we're seeing the increase in numbers. And the more people that do come forward, because the crimes are escalating, there's more violence involved. So whereas before you might have been, you know, raped but not necessarily beaten, now you're going to get raped and beaten because you better shut your mouth because the stakes have been raised.
Well, just in closing, Jennifer Norris, do you feel, and obviously it's early days yet with the charges just being brought today against Brigadier General Jeffrey Sinclair, the Deputy Commanding General of the 82nd Airborne Division, in Afghanistan, what do you think is likely to happen here in terms of helping you and other women who are victims of sexual abuse in the military?
Well, I think what's particular with this case is that if a brigadier general is doing this within the Army and he's in charge of all the people that he's in charge of, imagine the culture that one person has created within that, you know, battalion or squadron or whatever it is that he runs. They say that where sexual harassment is tolerated, you're more likely to see rapes occur. So part of the prevention piece is if sexual harassment is eliminated, it's going to help eliminate the culture of thinking that harassment, assault and rape are okay. And with this guy in charge and in Afghanistan, it's a very small military community. So I'm sure that his troops were aware of what he was doing, and I'm sure that affects morale as well. So this guy's going to be used as an example most likely because of his rank and because of the egregiousness of the charges that, you know, he's being pressed against him right now.
Well, Jennifer Norris, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Oh, thank you, too.
Again, I've been speaking with Jennifer Norris, who's a former U.S. Air Force tech sergeant who was forced into early retirement because of post-traumatic stress disorder from military sexual trauma. She currently volunteers at the Military Rape Crisis Center, helping both active duty and veteran victims of sexual violence. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking about President Obama's speech against human trafficking with a victim of sexual trafficking. Well, just in closing, Jennifer Norris, you mentioned suicide, that because of the lack of accountability and the lack of any comfort zone, if you will, for victims of sexual abuse inside the military, that some women are driven to suicide. What's your understanding about how pervasive that is and how desperate the situation is that that people would resort to killing themselves because they couldn't get anybody to take them seriously?
Well, what we're seeing is that right now it's the highest it's ever been. We have at least one active duty member per day that's committing suicide, and this is active duty. We're not even including the veterans. But all levels of suicide are at the highest they've ever been, and then what we're seeing is that when there are issues, whether it be, you know, someone that's got combat PTSD or someone that's got PTSD from military sexual trauma, is that they're not being dealt with while they're in the military. They're basically being tossed out with no aftercare, and then the VA is left to pick up the pieces, and because there's so many people heading to the VA, they're overwhelmed. So if people, if the military could take care of their people before they let them go, it would really help all of society. Because while that veteran is not getting into the VA because they're so backed up, they're by themselves and isolated and not necessarily realizing that they have PTSD, that it's normal, that, you know, if they just go and get some help for it, they'll see they're not alone and that they're not, you know, quote-unquote crazy.
I used to sail the deep and tranquil sea. But it washed me ashore, and it took my pearl and left an empty shell. I don't know where I am. They've taken all that.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Carissa Phelps, an attorney and motivational speaker and a youth advocate who works as part of a global collective to help local and international survivors of sex trafficking rebuild their lives. Her story was the subject of an award-winning documentary, Carissa, and she is the co-author of Runaway Girl, Escaping Life on the Streets, One Helping Hand at a Time. Welcome to Background Briefing, Carissa Phelps.
Thanks, Ian.
And on Tuesday in New York, both Mitt Romney and President Obama spoke at the Clinton Global Initiative. Mitt Romney spoke about freedom of markets, whereas the president spoke about the slavery of human beings and the tragedy of human trafficking. What's your sense of what he has talked about in terms of the administration's efforts to address this global and very much local problem here in the United States?
Well, I know that a lot has been done with the State Department and work on sending experts out around the country to draft legislation and assist, you know, in areas where trafficking has not been identified as a problem, and that's great. We could do more as far as creating opportunities, and I think that Romney touched on that, you know, that we have to have sustainable opportunities. People need jobs to do. You can't just expect slavery to end and not create opportunities, and so that I think both of them could have an impact, both creating opportunities overseas and then also the awareness raising and drafting of legislation that has gone on under Obama's administration.
Well, of course, it's not often that you hear the President of the United States talking about human slavery and the modern form of slavery in terms of sex trafficking and in terms of people working in factories and fields on fishing boats, toiling for little to no pay. getting beaten. And then, of course, he went on to talk about when a little girl is sold by her impoverished families, girls my daughter's age run away from home or is lured by the false promise of a better life and then imprisoned in a brothel and tortured if she resists that slavery. It's barbaric and it's evil and it has no place in the civilized world. I haven't heard that before from any United States president, so...
Right. I mean, I think that's pretty profound that he was talking on it and on point on everything he said, and it should raise awareness that it is an issue globally and also locally. There was talk about it locally as far as the runaway concern. Also, labor trafficking is a local problem, and we have to work on that issue locally. And it's a long, hard road. That's the only thing I wish he would have maybe said. It's not easy, and it's not just about raising awareness anymore. Now it's taking action.
So tell me about what he said, the president said, in terms of efforts on the part of his administration to educate law enforcement and educators about the telltale signs of human trafficking. Now, as one who's been a victim of human trafficking, from your experience, do you think that the law enforcement people and educators and others that would deal with this problem really are aware of the scope of this problem?
No, I think, and I don't think it could be just a law enforcement initiative either, and that was a problem that started way back when the Traffic Victim Protection Act was originally funded. The only funding that came through was for law enforcement, and so service providers were not funded, and partnerships failed because it's not sustainable if you're working with an unfunded initiative. But law enforcement has done their part in raising awareness, and there are some great, great, great task force out there in law enforcement that are doing their job. And it's a culture shift, so it takes time. And I still see young women and girls that have run away that are exploited and then re-victimized by by law enforcement and not-so-just system.
Again, I'm speaking with Carissa Phelps, who's an attorney, a motivational speaker, and a youth advocate who works as part of a global collective to help local and international survivors of sex trafficking rebuild their lives. Her story was the subject of an award-winning documentary, Carissa, and she's the co-author of Runaway Girl, Escaping Life on the Streets, One Helping Hand at a Time. So your book is a very, very raw and honest account of what happened to you growing up in a family with 11 brothers and sisters in competing for food, sleeping around at your friends' places, and eventually your mother got tired of it and put you into a juvenile hall. And then you were back on the streets, ran away, and then running, of course, is a constant metaphor, I guess, in the story. And then eventually you kidnapped by a pimp and forced into prostitution. One of the things I found very powerful metaphorically in your book, and one of the phrases is how you had to learn to run towards healing. So is that pervasive amongst victims of sex trafficking, that their self-worth is so damaged that they may reject a helping hand if indeed it ever comes their way?
Absolutely. Trust is broken down, and trust is, it often leads to them being harmed. And so being trafficked and then someone reaching out with a helping hand, it's not always met with joy. You know, it's hard to receive help if you don't trust people in general. And so working with young women over the last 5 years, I've been able to see as well that it takes time. It takes time for that trust to build up, and the healing process takes years. One young woman recently said to me, you know, 6 months is not enough to deal with 21 years. And she had, you know, her abuse and neglect started, you know, at birth, and so she was dealing with a lot. And I just believe that we don't always have a very patient system where people can heal in the way that they need to. And so I believe in offering more support to survivors.
So, Carissa Phelps, let's talk about the scope of the problem and the work that you do, who you work with, and your understanding of how pervasive it is, because the president, in his speech at the Clinton Global Initiative, said we've got to call it by its true name, modern slavery. And again, I don't think the average American is necessarily aware of this problem and how pervasive it is. So give us your since you have very much a firsthand experience in this, give us your understanding of the problem and who's dealing with it.
Well, there's not great research out there. Polaris Project has done some studies, and so has Shared Hope International, to look at the problem here. We know that runaways are at risk, and that as soon as they're on the street, they're vulnerable, and they will be approached more than likely by someone who is going to want to traffic them in some way or exploit them in some way. And that's what we need to stop. That's why we need to have more beds for runaway youth, more homeless shelters for runaway youth, more shelters that focus on their needs and what their comfort level is to be as far as being in a shelter. And so more youth-focused outreach and shelters, I think, is critical. And then recognizing that trafficking, it's not just about sex trafficking in the U.S., there is labor trafficking as well. And so there are just different types of businesses that exploit youth, and off the top of my head, like magazine sales or some door-to-door activities that could be exploiting youth that we haven't really looked into and taken action against enough. And the other thing is, people in almost every community, when I go and speak, small communities in Kentucky and Kansas and Montana, they remind me that it's a problem everywhere, that it's not just in urban areas as maybe like movies would portray. It's a problem everywhere, and so we have to have local responses in place, local protocols in place that really, without them, we're going to have gaps in our service, because the service providers have to be local. It doesn't matter what we do on an issue level. If there's not people actually acting when someone is exploited locally, then, and a team of people usually, then that then we'll be failing.
But my understanding is that this is not a small problem here. One in seven American children apparently will run away from home, and one out of three will be asked, as you were, to take care of someone in,
right,
in the worst possible sense there. And the average age at which street children are bought and sold for purposes of sex is between 12 and 14. And
yes, I think people would be surprised if the very sad thing is that these are voiceless children who are oftentimes have been arrested, locked up, and I hear the stories of as young as 8 years old when it started. And sometimes there are neighborhoods that are dealing with generations of the exploitation. So great-grandmother, grandmother, mom, four or five generations of exploitation in their family, and it becomes normalized. So we don't have responses built up to deal with that yet either.
So tell us about, just because it's an unusual that somebody could both have the experiences that you have and come out on the other side and not only be healed, but to want to dedicate yourself to healing others. Tell us about your most vulnerable moment and how you were, as a runaway, were essentially kidnapped by this pimp called Icy.
Well, as a runaway, I actually first was taken into sex slavery by my friend's uncle, who took me to a location where he was going to house me and offer me housing and just basic necessities like food and, bring me a comb and a toothbrush if I would be his sexual slave. And that was the exchange. You take care of me, I'll take care of you. And I knew what it meant. And when I was trying to escape from that situation was when I met a woman who had been victimized and trafficked by Icy, this pimp. And she was really beat up, and I tried to help her. That was my heart. I wanted to help her. And I was 12 years old. All I had was a room that this friend's uncle had gotten me. And I took her back to it, and I let her get herself cleaned up a little. She was 6 months pregnant, beat up, and I just wanted to help her. And when she got there, she started to tell me how they needed money to get their car out of impound, and that she was, not able to make money because of her situation, because of being pregnant and beat up. And could she call her boyfriend? And her boyfriend then was Icy, who asked me to do them a favor, to go out and make this money for them. And as a 12-year-old wanting to help people, I thought I was doing the right thing for them. And that's how it happens. It's manipulation. It's some sort of, you'll be a part of my family, or we'll love you, and that's missing in the life of that child. And they don't get it at juvenile hall or in group homes. So when someone offers it to them, they're willing to do just about anything.
So the president, in his speech on Tuesday before the Clinton Global Initiative, talking about the scourge of human slavery and human trafficking, both globally and in the United States, did refer to the notion of a young girl trapped in that brothel, in that kind of life, crying herself to sleep every night. Did that happen to you?
Yeah, I didn't know where I was going to go, and I didn't think that I was going to live very long. And the days and the nights were filled with rape, and it didn't stop. It was going to be a very brutal life, and I could see that, and I couldn't get away. Not that even sometimes the door was unlocked because there was a deadbolt on the inside, and I didn't have a key to it, but sometimes if it was unlocked, I had the chance, it would look like, to escape, but I had nowhere to go, and I had no sense of where I was. And I had been traumatized and victimized and raped at gunpoint and choked and told I was nothing and that I belonged to someone and that I belonged to serve someone. And so when that door was open, I had trouble even leaving. And that was just a short period of my life. That was only 10 days. I work with young women who have been in that situation for years.
Again, I'm speaking with Caressa Phelps, who is an attorney and motivational speaker and youth advocate who works as part of a global collective to help local and international survivors of sex trafficking rebuild their lives. Her story was the subject of the award-winning documentary Caressa, and she is the co-author of Runaway Girl, Escaping Life on the Streets, One Helping Hand at a Time. So just in the last few minutes, Caressa, let's turn to the good people that happened in your life and how they brought you out of this darkness.
Ron Jenkins, by far, was the most amazing person that I met, the first person that was happy to see me every day. And even though it was in juvenile hall, I was very fortunate to meet someone like him who wanted to help me. And it was important to me that he was who he was, that he had lived a life himself growing up in South Central and been surrounded by drugs and violence, and himself had been in foster care. And I didn't feel judged by him, and so I was able to, when he asked me to tell him what happened, how did I get to this place where I was facing, you know, it looked like maybe death or prison was in my future. When he asked me, I was able to tell him, and that was the critical turning point in my life. And he did not respond with disgust or any type of negative feelings. He said, write it down, and he had me start to journal and share my story. And as I did, he got me help. He got me connected to people. He talked to my teachers. He became like a surrogate parent to me. And he took just a big interest in my healing. And it was amazing. When he did, other people did too. And so this math teacher photocopied an algebra book, and she was amazing, Mrs. W., Mrs. Wegerman. And she taught me algebra by photocopying a book three chapters at a time and letting me do the problems and giving me a test at the end of it. And so really I taught myself algebra in juvenile hall, and that boosted my self-esteem with every single problem that I got right. I got to find out I was good at something, and I got passionate about it.
And obviously you've finally got an education and indeed got a law degree from UCLA. What made you choose that path, the law?
Well, my undergraduate was in math, and I was going into law for business law, actually. I wanted to figure out how I could change things on the business side of things to make things better, more just. And then I ended up adding an MBA as well, so I got the law degree and MBA from UCLA, and that really expanded my view of the world and gave me more tools and resources to do the work that I do today.
So just in closing then, Caressa Phelps, back to President Obama's speech before the Clinton Global Initiative, talking about the modern form of human bondage, both slavery in terms of people who are desperate for work and find themselves trapped in factories, fishing boats, in a field, toiling for little or no pay, beaten if they try to escape, and then of course, the other form of slavery. And he also mentioned the slavery of boy soldiers turned into killers or forced to kill or be killed, and then the human sex trafficking as well. Most people listening are not aware of how pervasive the problem is here in the United States, and how, you know, in every town and neighborhood in the United States. You've mentioned you've traveled throughout the Midwest and Wyoming and states like that where you're giving these motivational speeches. What do you think our audience needs to know from you, from your experience? And more importantly, what can they do?
My initiative now is to connect with local survivors. I truly believe that they have the answers and the solutions. They know what's going on in this situation, and they know their path to healing and can help us understand what is available in our local communities that we can leverage and kind of use for other survivors that we're assisting, and then what is missing and what would have helped them. So I would ask anybody in any community to reach out to local survivors who are doing work in their community and strengthen their efforts and support them in what they're doing, learn from them, and talk to people who have survived this more, but also have them assist you in building a response.
But just in terms of what the president said, in terms of his administration's initiatives, are there any ways that citizens can detect what's going on right under their noses and do something about it?
Absolutely, absolutely. A school recently in a very small community had a 12-year-old missing, and she was a runaway, and most people just expected this bad behavior from this runaway girl, but what came out was that she was with a 20-year-old, quote-unquote, boyfriend, and the response needs to be more urgent than what people do right now. They put the blame on the kid, usually, 12 years old, 13 years old. They want to say, oh, you know, she's a very bad kid, and not respond appropriately. And so when a child that's 12 or 13 is missing from school or home or their placement, wherever they are, we need to do more investigating and elevate it as we would with any other missing child.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Carissa Phelps.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Carissa Phelps, who's an attorney, a motivational speaker, and a youth advocate who works as part of the global initiative to help local and international survivors of sex trafficking rebuild their lives. The story was the subject of the award-winning documentary Carissa, and she is the co-author of Runaway Girl, Escaping Life on the Streets, One Helping Hand at a Time. And this has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producers Michelle Manos and Tarek Mohammed. This program is available for streaming and podcasting at ianmasters.com, where we welcome your comments. And the conversation continues online at facebook.com/ianmastersmedia. I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time was night in America. A lady dressed in white with a man she loved, standing along the side of the pickup truck. A shot rang out in the night, just when everything seemed right. Another headline written down in America. The guy that lived next door in 305 appeared by 5:30.